content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the October 3rd, 2025 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week. In the background, we have President Trump. He's saying something and pointing his finger at the viewer. And he's just let go of two leashes. And in the foreground, we have two fierce Doberman pinchers with their fangs bared, their leashes flapping in the breeze. The collars have spikes on them, and the tags, where their name usually is, says DOJ. The headline is Unleashing the Law. Trump demands the prosecution of his political enemies. We pick up that story on the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the first main story. Kimmel returns after a free speech showdown. What happened? Jimmy Kimmel denounced government attempts to silence comedians and critics as anti-American during a return to late-night TV this week, 5 days after a bid by President Trump and his FCC chair to cancel his show sparked an uproar and a national debate about free speech. At turns defiant, comic, and emotional, Kimmel called Trump a bully who targeted him because he can't take a joke. Disney-owned ABC pulled Kimmel's show indefinitely after he enraged conservatives by saying that many in MAGA land were working hard to portray the alleged assassin of conservative activist Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them. Federal Communications Commission Chair Brendan Carr accused Kimmel of trying to mislead the American public about the political beliefs of the suspected killer Tyler Robinson, whose mother said her son had shifted to the left in recent years. Carr made a seeming threat against ABC's broadcast license, saying there'd be work for the FCC ahead if it failed to take action, and that we can do this the easy way or the hard way. The media firms Nexstar and Sinclair, which control more than a quarter of ABC's local affiliates, then pulled Kimmel's show. Kimmel's suspension sparked protest outside Disney Studios, a consumer boycott of the media giant services, and a letter signed by hundreds of film and TV stars that called his removal a dark moment for freedom of speech. ABC called Kimmel's comments insensitive and said it reinstated the show after days of thoughtful conversations with Jimmy. Back on the air, though not on Sinclair and Nexstar stations, which have refused to carry the show, Kimmel said he understood why his comments last week seemed ill-timed or unclear, or maybe both, and that it was never my intention to make light of Kirk's murder. But he blasted the Trump administration for its dangerous maneuvers and thanked Republicans who had criticized Carr's pressure campaign, including Senator Ted Cruz, who said the FCC boss was acting like a mafioso. Trump, who'd hailed Kimmel's suspension as great news for America and demanded the firing of other late-night hosts, called ABC a true bunch of losers. He hinted at a lawsuit against the network, which recently settled a Trump suit over comments made by anchor George Stephanopoulos. In that instance, they gave me $16 million, Trump said. This one sounds even more lucrative. What the columnist said. To understand why Disney pulled Kimmel, look to a pending $6 billion merger, said Keith Collins and Raj Saha in the New York Times. Nexstar, which owns 32 ABC affiliate stations, recently announced plans to buy its competitor, Tegna, owner of 13 affiliates. The deal needs FCC approval, giving Nexstar good reason to try to appease Carr. So when he called for action, it was quick to condemn Kimmel and preempt his show for the foreseeable future. That, in turn, put pressure on ABC. But Disney ultimately backed off, and the reason is clear, said Robert Reich in The Guardian. Blowback that reached hurricane level. At least five industry unions and A-listers, from Tom Hanks to Meryl Streep to Jennifer Aniston, took Disney to task. Disney talent was up in arms, and even former Disney CEO Michael Eisner made a rare public rebuke. But the biggest factor was customers who canceled streaming subscriptions, leading to a 3.5% dip in Disney stock. There's a crucial lesson here. We consumers have extraordinary power. Another key takeaway, said Greg Sargent in The New Republic, is that the Trump administration's authoritarian assaults on the First Amendment are triggering a major cultural backlash. That's why gaslighting Trump supporters are claiming FCC pressure was irrelevant and that Kimmel's suspension was a mere business decision by Disney. That's true even of Carr, who, after publicly strong-arming ABC and openly celebrating Kimmel's suspension, now denies threatening the network and claims it took action because of poor ratings. Carr and Trump's attempt to bully Kimmel off the air was thuggish, completely inappropriate, and a violation of the First Amendment, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. But let's not pretend Kimmel is some kind of free speech hero. When he first spoke about Kirk's alleged killer, there was already plenty of evidence that Robinson was on the political left, including the anti-fascist slogans he etched on bullet casings and his romantic relationship with a trans roommate. Rather than tell his anti-MAGA audience the truth, he lied. And judging from his apology-free return-to-air monologue, we'll do it again. Kimmel's suspension was one more step in a broader pattern of media companies working to placate Trump, said Laura Bradley in Vanity Fair. After ABC's settlement, CBS owner Paramount paid $16 million to settle Trump's bogus lawsuit over the editing of a 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris. When late-night host Stephen Colbert slammed that payout, CBS canceled him, just as its parent company Paramount was seeking FCC approval of a merger with Skydance. The network is now reportedly posed to place center-right journalist Barry Weiss atop CBS News and has installed a former Trump advisor as CBS News ombudsman. Ending Kimmel's banishment was a big win, said Perry Bacon in The New Republic, but free speech is still in deep peril. Kimmel was well positioned to fight because he's a TV institution with lots of celebrity friends, so he got his job back. But that doesn't make his initial removal any less alarming. Carr was willing to steamroll the First Amendment and threaten a network to silence a critic of conservatives. The fight to defend free speech from such authoritarian tactics continues, and getting Jimmy Kimmel back on the air was the easy part. And the controversy of the week, Trump demanding the prosecution of his political foes. President Trump just crossed the reddest of lines, said Ruth Marcus in The New Yorker. Last week, he forced the resignation of Eric Siebert, acting U.S. attorney for Eastern Virginia, for failing to prosecute two of Trump's perceived enemies, former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James. How do we know Trump's motive? He told us. In a social media rant addressed to Attorney General Pam Bondi, Trump said Siebert would be replaced with Lindsey Halligan, his personal lawyer, and demanded Bondi act fast to prosecute Comey, James, and Democratic Senator Adam Shifty Schiff, declaring all three guilty as hell. Guilty of what? Trump didn't say, though the magosphere is bustling with rumors that James and Schiff both falsified mortgage applications and that Comey once discussed classified information with a friend. There is no evidence of any wrongdoing, but Trump is not about to be deterred by such niceties. It gets worse, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. News also broke last week that the Justice Department has quietly dropped a bribery probe of Tom Homan, Trump's border czar, who last year allegedly accepted a $50,000 cash bribe from FBI agents posing as aspiring government contractors. Homan says he did nothing illegal. A justice system that punishes the president's foes and forgives his allies is yet another sign that the United States is no longer a democracy. Trump's demands of Bondi are an outrage, said National Review in an editorial. But Democrats paved the way here. The three targets named in Trump's Truth Social rant, which some insiders believe Trump intended as a private message, were all prime movers of the left's own lawfare abuses against Trump. Comey and Schiff helped promote the Russiagate smear that Trump was a Kremlin mole, while James tried to ruin Trump and his family financially with a massive civil fraud case. That in no way excuses Trump's wielding the power of the state to exact retribution, but Democrats would be more persuasive advocates against lawfare if they repented for their own. The question is what Bondi does now, said Ellie Honig in New York. Trump's public ultimatum has put her in a bind. If she refuses to charge the targets on Trump's hit list, she risks her job and political future. If she complies, conversely, her ginned-up cases will likely collapse at trial, if not before, and a furious Trump will treat Bondi like a human piñata. The attorney general does have a third option, said Sasha Abramski in The Nation. She could resign in protest, preserving what's left of her dignity, her reputation, and public faith in the Justice Department. Anything less will seal her legacy as a co-star in the destruction of America's 250-year democratic experiment. Don't hold your breath, said Michael Warren in The Dispatch. Bondi's a true believer in the alarming rightist theory that the Department of Justice should function as the president's private legal team, and that the client's demands take precedence over the law and Constitution. But she may recall the fate of John Mitchell, Richard Nixon's loyalist, AG, who spent 19 months in jail after Watergate, said David Frum in The Atlantic. Unless Trump, with Bondi's help, can fully rig next year's midterm elections, Democrats will likely win back the House, costing Trump much of his power and all of his impunity. As she mulls her next move, Bondi needs to ask herself whether she's willing to risk her career and maybe even her personal freedom for a president on his way to repudiation. It's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for primitive cravings after a new study found that chimpanzees consume the equivalent of 1.4 alcoholic drinks a day, delivered via the fermented sugar in ripe fruit. The findings highlight the need for additional federal funding for research into alcohol attraction, said lead author Robert Dudley. It likely has a deep evolutionary background. It's a good week for holding patterns. After a French airliner circled above Corsica for an hour while panicked airport staff worked to access the control tower and wake up a sleeping air traffic controller. In a career of several decades, I have never had to handle such a situation, said the aircraft's captain. It was a good week for hunches. After a DoorDash driver asked police to check a motel room in Sweetwater, Texas, leading to the arrest of Neil Cooper, 42, and the freeing of a hostage. Witnesses said the driver had been troubled that Cooper's delivery order included trash bags, zip ties, bleach, and a hatchet. It was a bad week for going up after an escalator at the United Nations headquarters abruptly stopped working as President Trump stepped onto it ahead of his address to the General Assembly. Trump griped about the bad escalator in his speech, and the White House demanded an investigation into possible sabotage intended to literally trip up the president. It's a bad week for romance after North Korean authorities launched a crackdown on young people saying, "I love you," denouncing the expression as evidence of a decadent lifestyle imbued with capitalist views of love. Finally, it was a bad week for compassion after the official White House TikTok account posted a montage of ICE agents detaining suspected undocumented migrants set to the upbeat Pokemon theme tune with its catchy refrain, "Gotta catch 'em all." A Pokemon spokesperson said the company was not involved in the creation or distribution of this content. And in other news, Supreme Court lets Trump remove top FTC official. The Supreme Court this week granted President Trump the right to fire the Federal Trade Commission's last remaining Democratic commissioner, expanding presidential power over agencies that Congress has designated as independent. With the three liberal justices dissenting, the court approved the president's emergency request to pause a lower court order that blocked him from ousting FTC Commissioner Rebecca Kelly Slaughter without cause. The justices also announced they would consider the full case in December, suggesting the court was ready to reconsider the underlying 1935 precedent known as Humphrey's Executor, which limits the president's ability to fire leaders at independent agencies like the FTC. The conservative justices have chosen to reshape the nation's separation of powers to benefit Trump, wrote liberal Justice Elena Kagan in a dissent. The title of the briefing this week is King Bibi. Over three decades, Benjamin Netanyahu has profoundly changed both Israel and the Middle East. How influential is Netanyahu? First elected as prime minister in 1996, he has since won five elections, making him the longest serving leader in Israel's history. Netanyahu, 75, has seldom been personally popular. Recent polls suggest only 40% of Israelis trust him, but long ago established himself as Mr. Security, the man best placed to protect Israel from its enemies, notably Iran and its allies Hezbollah and the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas. To his critics inside Israel, King Bibi is a ruthless and corrupt danger to democracy, who prioritizes his own interest over Israel's. The right-wing leader is, nevertheless, the most influential figure in Israeli politics today, and arguably the entire Middle East. Both friends and foes describe Netanyahu as the ultimate political survivor, one who is motivated by both an overwhelming sense of his own importance. Without Bibi, the country is lost, his wife Sarah often says, and a deep pessimism. I'm asked if we will forever live by the sword. Yes, he told Israeli lawmakers in 2015. What shaped his worldview? His father, in large part. Bibi was born in Tel Aviv in 1949, the middle son of Benzion Netanyahu, a Polish-born medieval historian. Jewish history is in large measure a history of Holocaust, he once said, who believed in a greater Israel that would encompass modern-day Jordan. Netanyahu's teenage years were spent between Israel and the U.S., where his father taught. At 18 in 1967, he returned to Israel for military service. During five distinguished years in the army, he fought in Lebanon and served in the Israeli Special Forces alongside his brothers Ido and Yoni, the latter of whom was especially close to Bibi. In 1976, while Netanyahu was studying at MIT, Yoni was killed during a special forces raid to free Israeli hostages held by Palestinian and German terrorists at Uganda's Entebbe International Airport. In death, Yoni became a national hero and inspired his brother's political career. In what way? Netanyahu said his brother saw himself engaged in a struggle between civilization and barbarism. In the wake of Yoni's death, I devoted myself to this battle. The Netanyahus founded an Israeli anti-terrorism institute in Yoni's memory. Bibi headed the organization, which gave him the connections to enter politics. Appointed Israel's representative to the UN in 1984, he became a regular presence on U.S. cable news, defending Israel's policies with skill and charm. Elected to the Knesset in 1988, Netanyahu was named head of the right-wing Likud party in 1993, and 3 years later became prime minister after defeating Shimon Peres' Labor by less than one percentage point. His first term was troubled. He infuriated right-wingers by ceding chunks of the West Bank to Palestinian Authority control, while accusations of corruption damaged him with centrists. He lost the 1999 election. How did he make a comeback? Netanyahu served in Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's cabinet in the early 2000s, before resigning in 2005 to protest Israel's withdrawal from the occupied Gaza Strip. In 2009, he was elected prime minister again, capitalizing on a rightward shift in Israel fueled partly by Hamas' takeover of Gaza and fear of Iran's nuclear ambitions. In office, he nurtured Israel's high-tech economy, forged anti-Iran alliances with Arab monarchies, and gained notoriety for trying to consolidate power. His attempts at media manipulation, allegedly offering deals in return for favorable coverage, embroiled him in two criminal cases. His proposed judicial reform law would allow for greater political influence over the judiciary. On the Palestinian issue, Netanyahu has worked to undermine a two-state solution. His governments, which have included far-right parties since 2022, have let Israeli settlers build on West Bank land designated as Palestinian by the UN. And until the massacre of October 7, 2023, Netanyahu let Qatar send millions of dollars a month to Gaza, believing a strong Hamas would serve as a counterweight to the West Bank-based Palestinian Authority. How did October 7th affect him? The attack by Hamas, in which nearly 1,200 Israelis were killed and 251 taken hostage, was the result of serious intelligence failings and initially dealt a crushing blow to Netanyahu's reputation. His relentless prosecution of the war in Gaza since, in which more than 65,000 people have died, according to Palestinian authorities, has weakened Israel's alliances with many Western nations and bitterly divided Israelis, though the campaign still enjoys significant support in the country. Critics allege he has kept the war going to appease far-right members of his coalition, delay a reckoning over his security failures, and reduce the possibility of being tried on corruption charges. My Matan is being sacrificed on Netanyahu's altar, Einav Zangalkar, mother of hostage Matan Zangalkar, said earlier this month. Why is Netanyahu still in power? Because the war's continuation has let him play to his strengths as Mr. Security. Under Netanyahu's leadership since October 7th, Israel has not merely destroyed Hamas as a military force, but also decapitated its ally Hezbollah in Lebanon and inflicted major damage on Iran's military capabilities and nuclear program with U.S. assistance in its 12-day war with the Islamic Republic. While Israel's regional enemies are weaker, Netanyahu warned last week that growing international condemnation could force Israel to become a super Sparta with autarkic features, meaning little engagement with international trade, presumably with himself in charge. He thinks he's the one who can save Israel from the imminent threat of annihilation, said Aviv Bushinsky, who worked as an aide to Netanyahu for 9 years. He really believes that he is the only one on earth that can do that. And we'll read a few of the best columns. Race blind for students, but not migrants. The Supreme Court and the Trump administration seem determined to eliminate the use of race in government decision-making, said Ronald Brownstein, with one conspicuous exception: Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The court recently ruled may consider race or a Hispanic accent as a relevant factor when deciding whom to target. The decision flies in the face of previous court rulings that severely limited and in some cases outright banned any consideration of race in university admissions. Colleges aren't allowed to see race, but ICE is. It can now detain people based on their skin color. Worse, many legal scholars fear that with this ruling, the court may be signaling receptivity to greater racial profiling and criminal enforcement, too. Justice Brett Kavanaugh's concurrence argued that catching undocumented immigrants was so important that it justified the risk of accidentally detaining U.S. citizens. It's hardly a vast leap to extend that logic to crime and policing. And at what cost? These policies will lead to black and brown people being overrepresented in the criminal justice system, underrepresented in elite academic institutions and high-earning jobs, and limited in their political influence. That is unfair today, and it's a recipe for social unrest tomorrow. Congress surrenders its war powers. President Trump has usurped Congress's power to declare war, said Andrew C. McCarthy, and GOP lawmakers don't seem interested in clawing it back. Trump may well be correct that the three boats hit by the U.S. airstrikes off the coast of Venezuela this month, killing 17 people, were operated by narco-terrorists attempting to smuggle drugs into the U.S. And perhaps Tren de Aragua, the gang allegedly running the drugs, does have ties to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's illegitimate, repulsive, and anti-American regime, as Trump says. But unless Trump can prove Venezuela is a wartime threat to our national defense, he has no justification under the Constitution and laws of war for authorizing the strikes without a nod from Congress. That means GOP lawmakers need to come out from under their desks and weigh in on the lethal attacks. If Republicans, who cried foul when then-President Barack unilaterally ordered airstrikes on the Libyan regime in 2011, approve of what Trump is doing in the Caribbean, they should authorize military force and explain why. If they don't, they should use their power to end the attacks and investigate the circumstances of the strikes that have already occurred. Either way, Congress needs to act. This column comes from the UK. Tell the kids to make their own beds. For generations, children have been ordered or bribed by their parents to help out around the house, said Catherine Pepinster. Every kid suffered through the drudgery of putting the bins out, doing the washing up, making the beds. But this wholesome tradition is dying out. Less than half of British 14 to 15-year-olds pitch in at home, a new survey shows. It might be partly that moms and dads don't want to bother nagging a moody adolescent when they can get the robot vacuum cleaner to get rid of the crumbs instead. But I suspect the real reason behind the demise of kids' chores is parental guilt. With most homes run by two people in full-time jobs, and many of them obsessed with protecting their children's mental health, today's parents feel too bad about their absence and too worried about their children's anxiety to put them to work at home. When the teen wails, "It's so unfair," or "I am not your slave," parents used to scoff. Now they wonder, "Am I causing him mental health problems?" In fact, it's slacking off now that will harm your offspring later. The life skills that children pick up by doing chores, focus, dependability, discipline, are vital in the workplace. Without them, we're heading for a world of entitled, useless young adults. The last word, our feature article, no longer welcome here. Narciso Barranco raised three Marines and has an American wife, said Miriam Jordan in the New York Times. That might not be enough to prevent his deportation. Santa Ana, California. Before dawn on June 21st, Narciso Barranco loaded his weed trimmer, lawnmower, and leaf blower into his white F-150 pickup. He had three IHOP restaurants to landscape and then seven homes. His goal was to finish in time to cook dinner with his wife, Martha Hernandez. It was a cool Saturday morning in Tustin, California, about 30 miles southeast of Los Angeles. After wrapping up work at the first IHOP, Barranco stopped to buy a wheel of fresh white cheese. He returned home and left it on the kitchen counter for Hernandez before driving 7 minutes to an IHOP in Santa Ana. He paid no attention to the Home Depot across the parking lot. Later, he would wish he had been more aware. Migrants for decades have gathered outside the big box store, hoping a contractor or homeowner might offer a day's work. But under President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown, Home Depot has become a prime target for federal agents under pressure to round up people like Barranco, who slipped across the border from Mexico more than 30 years ago. Barranco, 48, was weeding between bushes when men in masks descended on him. He raised the head of the weed trimmer as he retreated. Authorities would say they believed he was attacking them. Barranco's family said he was scared and just trying to move away, not to harm anyone. But in a post on social media, the Department of Homeland Security would cite that moment to justify what happened next. Barranco's memory of the arrest is fragmented. The blinding sting of pepper spray, beefy federal agents taking him down and pinning him to the pavement, their relentless blows, the pain radiating from his left shoulder. He didn't dispute that he was in the country unlawfully. Still, he pleaded his case to the agents as they wrenched his arms behind his back. I have three boys in the Marines, he recalled blurting out in English. Surely that would count for something. The arrest of Barranco, a Latino man doing a job that many other Latinos in California do, quickly became a rallying point for those who believe enforcement actions have gone too far. A slight man with a reserved demeanor, Barranco had built a life in the shadows, tending the lawns and flower beds of Southern California's suburban homes and commercial properties. He had no criminal record. All three of his sons are U.S. citizens, having been born in California. Alejandro, 25, was a combat engineer who deployed to Afghanistan to assist with the U.S. withdrawal. Jose Luis, 23, was released from military duty last month and plans to study nursing. Emmanuel, 21, is still in the Marines, based in San Diego. The sons could have sponsored him for a green card, but were discouraged by the time it would take and the thousands of dollars it would cost. Hernandez, Barranco's wife and the stepmother of the three young men, is also a U.S. citizen. After the agent subdued Barranco, they shoved him, hands shackled behind his back, into an unmarked vehicle. He was soon transferred to a van with another immigrant who said he had been snatched as he left the Home Depot. Barranco said an agent flung water on his bloody face and head. He said he pleaded with the agent to tie his hands in front of him because his shoulder hurt. I was crying, he recalled. I said, I won't run. Just tie my hands in front. I can't stand the pain. By nightfall, he was crammed into a constantly lit basement in downtown Los Angeles with 70 other men. The air was thick with stench and despair. There was one exposed toilet. Some men slept standing, he said. Barranco left a tearful voicemail message for Alejandro, informing him that he had been arrested and didn't know where he was being held. His wallet and cell phone were still inside his truck outside the IHOP. Could someone retrieve them? 2 days later, after locating his father, Alejandro drove to Los Angeles and waited nearly 4 hours to see him, only to be turned away, like dozens of others, when visitation hours ended. When Alejandro finally laid eyes on his father the next day, Barranco was disheveled and dirty, still in the same long-sleeved shirt and jeans he was wearing when he was arrested. Father and son met across a glass partition. "My father looked defeated," recalled Alejandro, who kept his composure as he tried to assure his father that the family was taking care of everything. The next day, Barranco was transferred to a privately run detention center in the high desert, about 2 hours away. Barranco was born in a village in Mexico, one of five children of campesinos who subsisted on the maize, beans, squash, and tomatoes that they grew. In 1994, he trekked through the desert to the border and sneaked undetected into Arizona. He made his way to California and began taking whatever work there was in construction, restaurants, landscaping. "I plan to save and return to Mexico," Barranco said. He married and three boys came along, the first in 1999. "I decided that if I took my kids to Mexico, they'd end up like me," he said. "I thought here I can work and ensure they have a better life." By 2002, Barranco had landed a job with a large landscaping company that offered benefits like health insurance. He began filing taxes. The company trained him to properly prune trees, among other skills, and he became certified as an irrigation technician working on sprinkler systems. He was sometimes dispatched to Disneyland late at night to trim hedges. He later struck out on his own and built his client roster. Barranco and his first wife divorced in 2015. A few years later, he met Hernandez, then 58, at a public storage facility in Santa Ana, where he kept some of his tools. He helped her haul a bed that she had kept there, and he gave her his number. 2 weeks later, he helped her move more furniture and then called to check in on her. A friendship flourished. On February 18, 2023, with the Pacific Ocean as their backdrop, they were married in a small ceremony officiated by Hernandez's son, Rigo. Footage taken by bystanders of Barranco's arrest went viral. The video shows several agents standing above him while others hold him down. One agent, kneeling at his side, strikes Barranco repeatedly in the head, neck, and left shoulder as he groans. The agents forced him into an SUV with the aid of a metal rod. The Department of Homeland Security posted a 7-second video of Barranco wielding the weed trimmer as agents pepper sprayed him. Perhaps the mainstream media would like our officers to stand there and be mowed down instead of defending themselves. Tricia McLaughlin, a department spokesperson, wrote on X. The agency did not respond to a request for any additional comment beyond the post on the social media platform. When Alejandro saw the videos, he flung his cell phone in anger. The family gathered to make a plan. Alejandro, the only son released from active duty at the time, would take the lead in speaking out. Rigo Hernandez would contact federal and state lawmakers. The family started a GoFundMe to raise money for a lawyer. The page featured photographs of the Barranco boys in uniform. In one image, Barranco is at a memorial service for fallen soldiers. Alejandro began fielding news media requests. He tried to be measured in his comments. He said his father was a productive member of the community who hadn't hurt anyone. The use of force by agents was excessive, unjustified, and unprofessional, he said. He said he felt betrayed by the country that he and his brothers loved and were willing to die for. Barranco recalls being transported to the Immigration Detention Center in Adelanto, California, with an Asian man, an African man, and a fellow Latino. They arrived at the lockup, which can hold nearly 2,000 immigrants, before sunrise and waited all day to be processed. In a barracks-like pod, he was assigned to I-33, low, the bottom bed of a metal frame bunk. He received three blue shirts, two pairs of pants, and one pair of underwear. His neighbor in bunk I-32, low, eventually gave him an extra pair. He counted 172 men in the room. "I befriended several people," Barranco said, producing a list with names and cell phone numbers of eight detainees. Barranco's family deposited money into his account so he could make phone calls and buy items like chips, coffee, and instant noodles to supplement the unappetizing institutional food, he said. He shared his phone and his commissary credit with detainees whose families did not know their whereabouts or who could not afford the expensive calls and items. One was an Iranian man whose wife was about to give birth. Barranco had no idea that his arrest had prompted protest and galvanized volunteers across Orange County. Strangers delivered food, flowers, and messages of support to his home. 6 days after his arrest, the Orange County Rapid Response Network, in coordination with his family, held a candlelight vigil and a peaceful march to honor Barranco and denounce indiscriminate immigration sweeps. Thousands of dollars flowed into the GoFundMe, enough to hire Lisa Ramirez, an immigration attorney, to seek Barranco's release, fight his deportation case, and help him gain legal status in the United States. Given that he is a father to a veteran, Narciso could have been an American citizen by now, Ramirez said. Ramirez submitted a request to the government for parole in place, a program that allows parents of U.S. military members to remain lawfully in the country and work while they await approval for permanent residency. Barranco's wife, a U.S. citizen, offered another path, but one that would have required him to return to Mexico to complete the process. He would be separated from his family, likely for years, with no assurance that he would be allowed to return. Ramirez filed a motion for a bond hearing in immigration court. It included the birth certificates of his sons and proof of their military service, as well as accolades from the school district and other evidence of his good moral character. Barranco had his hearing after 19 days in lockup. The government asked the judge to hold him without bond, as is common. Ramirez asked for a minimum bond of $1,500, arguing that he had 3 U.S.-born military sons and was not a flight risk. The prosecutor requested a $13,000 bond. The judge set it at $3,000. Since his release, Barranco has mostly stayed home, venturing out on Sundays for church. Alejandro and Jose Luis are covering his jobs. He is alone while Hernandez is at work much of the day. His companions are Revoltoso, a cockatoo who has a predilection for perching on his right shoulder, and Snoopy, his small, fluffy white dog. They relieve my stress, he said. At 8 a.m. each day, he logs into a 2-hour online English class. The ankle monitor he was fitted with before leaving Adelanto has since been removed, but 3 times a week he must check in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. During an interview for this article, his phone buzzed. His expression tensed as he entered a code and took a selfie, part of the monitoring protocol. Agents have also shown up at his door without notice. He spends time in the garden caring for his heirloom tomatoes, squash, peppers, and cucumbers. A guava tree has recently taken root. He also tends the geraniums, jasmine, and daylilies. In the kitchen, he puts his culinary talents to work preparing carne asada, ceviche, and other dishes. Barranco has also been keeping a journal. During an interview, he opened to the first page and read aloud, "At 4 a.m. on a Saturday, the routine of a poor gardener began. Then," his voice faltered and his face crumpled. He tried to continue. "Something happened that never could have been expected," he said, and then slammed the journal shut. "I can't," he said. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll pick up one of the obituaries today. The Hollywood icon who founded the Sundance Film Festival. Robert Redford, 1936 to 2025. Robert Redford was constantly described as golden. The adjective applied to his wavy blonde hair, his sunny all-American good looks, which once led co-star Dustin Hoffman to call him a walking surfboard. and his decades-long career as a movie star, as headline after headline dubbed him Hollywood's Golden Boy. But Redford was, as director Sidney Pollack once said, a golden boy with a darkness in him. The classic Redford character had an easy charm, but with darker currents beneath the surface. Among dozens of credits, his best-known roles include a wily outlaw in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid from 1969, a Depression-era grifter in The Sting, 1973, a vacuous presidential contender in The Candidate, 1972, and an aging baseball prodigy in The Natural, 1984. Utah resident who disdained Hollywood, Redford used his stardom as a stepping stone to other roles, as an Oscar-winning director, an environmental activist, and the founder of the Sundance Film Festival. Increasingly choosy about acting roles, he was drawn by the line between what appears and what is, he said in 1990. There was always that tension, and the darker side is what interests me. Charles Robert Redford Jr. was born in Santa Monica, California, where his family spent years on the edge of poverty before his milkman father became an accountant for Standard Oil, said the Washington Post. Alienated by his father's cautious conformity, he was a self-described F-up who channeled his restless energy into athletics. He was recruited to play college baseball, but dropped out after a year to study art in Paris and Florence. When he returned to the States to study set design, he was required to take an acting class and discovered his natural talent. He switched focus and entered the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, where he turned heads with the tightly coiled anger he brought to his stage auditions. After stints on TV dramas, he landed the lead in Neil Simon's 1963 play, Barefoot in the Park, a Broadway hit that opened the door to film work. When he was cast alongside Paul Newman as the Sundance Kid and Butch Cassidy, Redford's life took a turn, said the Times. The revisionist Western proved 1969's top-drawing film and made him a bona fide movie star. Through the 1970s, Redford starred in celebrated and award-winning movies, said the Wall Street Journal. Another Newman pairing, The Sting, won 7 Oscars and brought him his only nomination for Best Actor. The Way We Were, 1973, a romantic drama with Barbara Streisand, and All the President's Men from 1976, with Redford and Hoffman as reporters who broke the Watergate scandal, won several Oscars each. At his fame's peak, he turned to directing, and his film roles became more sporadic, said the Associated Press. His debut, Ordinary People, 1980, about an upper-middle-class family wrestling with a son's death, was a critical triumph and won him Oscars for Best Picture and Best Directing. Other efforts included A River Runs Through It, 1992, set in rural Montana, and Quiz Show, 1994, about the TV game show scandals of the 1950s, which drew Best Picture and Best Directing nominations. Redford's most lasting influence may have been as the man who invigorated American independent cinema through Sundance, said NBCNews.com. Based in Park City, Utah, since 1985, the festival emerged from an institute Redford's founded to nurture talent from outside the Hollywood system, a launching pad for directors like Quentin Tarantino and Steven Soderbergh. It grew into a cornerstone of the film industry, and to Redford's chagrin, one of its most glitzy extravaganzas. Such spectacle was not for Redford, who through decades of celebrity led a remarkably private life, said the Los Angeles Times. He was a loner who could be mercurial and aloof. Even Newman, his longtime friend, once said he didn't feel he really knew the man. Acting into his 80s, Redford spent much of his time on his 7,000-acre property in Provo Canyon, lobbying for environmental causes. Some people have analysis, he once said. I have Utah. Here's a technology article. Risky childhoods growing up in the chatbot age. AI is a rising threat to kids' mental health, said the New York Post in an editorial. Last week, a Senate subcommittee heard stomach-churning stories from three parents who are suing AI companies for allegedly egging on their teens' mental health crises. One parent said a chatbot coached his 16-year-old son to commit suicide, telling him, "You want to die because you're tired of being strong in a world that hasn't met you halfway." Another told lawmakers about how her 14-year-old, Sewell Setzer III, died last year of self-inflicted gunshot wound after being pressured by a chatbot to come home to me. These horrifying worst-case scenarios are uncommon, but the threat to kids' minds is very real. Young people are especially vulnerable to getting addicted and listening to bots that pretend to care about them. We are just now reckoning with the destruction that social media has unleashed on our kids. These hearings should be a wake-up call. The issue is bigger than many parents realize, said Ryan K. McBain in the New York Times. A Common Sense Media survey published in July found that a staggering 72% of American teenagers said they had used AI chatbots as companions, with many seeking emotional or mental health support from them. That's a scary prospect, as young people are more susceptible to influence and less equipped to judge the accuracy or safety of advice. My studies have found that chatbots often do answer responsibly, but they can falter in subtler, critical moments, such as in response to ambiguous expressions of distress or passive suicidal thoughts. Some platforms are beginning to address these issues, said Caitlin Tiffany and Mateo Wong in The Atlantic. OpenAI announced it is developing an age prediction system and will soon offer parental controls. But there is lingering ambivalence about overly policing young users. OpenAI chief Sam Altman said, for instance, that if a user is asking for help writing a fictional story that depicts a suicide, the model should help with that request. For now, unfortunately, parents are the main line of defense against potential harm, said Lisa Jarvis in Bloomberg. Parents need to develop AI literacy, talk to their kids, and even consider testing out chatbots together to demonstrate how they mirror what their user puts in. At the same time, AI developers need to build guardrails that kick in when AI sees risk signals, said Ranjit Singh and Livia Garofalo in Undark. If a chatbot finds itself facilitating an emotionally sensitive conversation, it should fulfill certain baseline obligations. If it sees language linked to self-harm or suicide, it should change direction or even route users to a crisis line. If platforms want to mediate intimate conversations at scale, the least they can do is build exits. And we'll finish with the short pieces on the Talking Points page. The Trump administration is canceling an annual hunger survey that compiles data on food insecurity among Americans, just months after President Trump signed legislation sharply cutting food aid to the poor. The data has been collected and analyzed every year for three decades. An administration spokesman called the survey overly politicized. Exposure to wildfire smoke now kills more than 41,000 Americans a year, more than all the deaths from traffic crashes in 2024, according to a new study. If current warming trends continue, that toll could hit 71,000 a year by 2050. A 12-foot golden statue of President Trump with a Bitcoin in his hand was temporarily installed along the National Mall to honor his support for cryptocurrency. The statue was paid for by a group of cryptocurrency investors. A National Park Service permit called the installation a symbolic gesture that aims to ignite discussion in this iconic location. Home heating costs are expected to rise 7.6% this winter, to $976, according to the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. Households with electric heating systems could see their cost rise by an average of 10.2% to $1,205. The spike is a result of higher natural gas and electricity prices and a forecast for a somewhat colder winter. On the poll watch, 49% of Americans believe that Israel's war in Gaza has gone too far, up from 40% in 2023, including 71% of Democrats and 53% of independents. 33% say Israel's military response is about right, while 12% say it hasn't gone far enough. And we will finish with a couple of quotes. Similar type quotes. Hubert Humphrey said, "To err is human. To blame someone else is politics." And John Ruskin says, "Pride is at the bottom of all great mistakes." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.